Freeman Dyson is 93 years old. He's one of the world's great physicists, and he spent his career working and playing and eating and probably drinking with physics' dream team. Richard Feynman, Wolfgang Pauli, Robert Oppenheimer, people who split the atom, built the nuclear bomb, refined quantum theory. They're all gone now. But Dyson still works at the place he spent most of his career, Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study. Steve Paulson caught up with him there.
I want to start out by taking you back to your very first dreams of becoming a scientist when you were a child. When did you first fall in love with numbers?
Oh, when I was about three, I believe. I mean, before I could read, I was certainly calculating, and it was just a toy I loved to play with, and I don't know where it came from.
So from the whole time when you were growing up and to the time that you were going to college, you kind of knew that you would become a scientist or at least a mathematician?
Yes, it was more mathematics than science, but I read a lot of science, and of course there were lots of good popular science books. I read Eddington and, of course, Wells, who were very good writers, and they made science enticing.
So you also read science fiction, and that was part of the appeal?
Yes. I mean, what I remember most vividly was Jules Verne. I read Hector Servadac, who was one of the books of Verne, about an expedition to a planet. I must have been about 8 years old when I read that, and I thought it was all true, and came as a big disappointment. Later on, I discovered it was just a story.
Why did you choose not to stay in pure mathematics once you got to college? Why did you go into physics?
Well, it was partly, I think, because of the bomb that just about that time I made the switch. I was in England all through the war, and because we knew nothing about nuclear bombs. And then suddenly Hiroshima, and then the war was over. So we were just hugely grateful to these physicists who had somehow brought the war to an end. And then I thought, well, it would be interesting to get to know those people. And in addition, of course, there was quantum mechanics. And I had the feeling everything I did in mathematics was of interest only to five or six people in the whole world. Whereas if I worked in physics, I'd be doing something with much more public consequence, and in the end would be more important. And so that was a reason for switching.
So then after the war, you went to Cornell as a graduate student in the late 40s, and you ended up working with one of the towering figures in physics.
Hans Bethe, yes.
Did he become a mentor to you?
Yes, very much so. An extraordinarily good one. I mean, he was amazing with students, and he always found the right problem for each student, just difficult enough, not too difficult. So he was an ideal person to have as a mentor.
What was the right problem for you?
Well, it was concerned with quantum electrodynamics, which was just bursting open at that time. Microwaves were invented during the war for military purposes, for radar. And it turns out microwaves were just what you needed to study quantum mechanics with great accuracy. And it turned out the standard quantum theory gave the wrong answers. So something quite new was needed. And Bethe worked it out. You know, Bethe had this extraordinary ability to do very simple calculations, which were quite sloppy, but gave roughly the right answer. And then he gave me the problem of doing the same calculation, but much more accurately. So that's what I did.
And then you met Richard Feynman, and you ended up working with him on quantum electrodynamics.
Well, I never worked with Feynman, but I learned a tremendous lot from him. Because he was a young professor, I was just a student. So I listened to Feynman, and of course, he was a genius, and he was also a clown, and he loved to perform, and so he always needed an audience. So I was very happy to be the audience.
Of course, there have been so many stories that have come up around Feynman over the years. You already said he was a genius, but what made him different from other scientists?
Well, he was extremely original. He had his own way of doing science, which was different from everybody else. That's why he had a hard time to communicate. He never wrote down equations. Most people, I mean, this is in physics especially, you do physics is you write down an equation and then you find out what are the solutions. But that wasn't the way Feynman did it. Feynman just would write down the solutions without ever writing down the equations. So it seemed like a sort of magic. The fact that he thought in terms of pictures instead of equations, and he scribbled little pictures on paper, and nobody understood what they meant. So that was my job, to translate Feynman into language other people could understand.
Now, you never got your PhD, did you?
No. I was so lucky I slipped through the cracks.
You were lucky? You didn't want a PhD?
No, I hate the PhD. I think it destroys people's lives. I had actually three tragedies which I witnessed with people who came to work with me and came to grief. One of them committed suicide. Two of them ended up in mental institutions. And I blame the PhD system for that. I mean, I think it really was a disaster for many people.
Why do you blame the PhD system? Just because it grinds people down? It takes so long?
Yes. And it's completely inappropriate for what most people need. I mean, it was designed for German academics in the 19th century. And for that, it was fine. But for any other kind of life, it's totally wrong. It takes far too long. It forces you to sort of pretend to be a researcher when most people don't want to be researchers. It's become a union card. And I think it's highly destructive.
And that was never a problem for you, not having the PhD, not having that credential?
No, fortunately. In those days, it wasn't as rigid as it has become later.
When you did get to Princeton, there were, of course, many famous scientists there, including Albert Einstein. Did you ever get to know him?
No, and he didn't encourage the young people to get to know him. He never came to our seminars. He never came to lunch. All we saw him walk by every day. Of course, he was tremendously busy with affairs of the world. He was very much in demand. So he just didn't have time for saying hello to the kids.
But it sounds like he didn't want to say hello either. I mean, that was not part of his makeup to deal with the up-and-coming generation.
That was true, and he didn't enjoy teaching. So for him, I mean, there were two important things. There was his own work, which he always continued, and there was his public activity as a politician, which he did extremely well. I mean, he really took it seriously and actually had a good effect.
You're talking about in terms of matters of war and peace and...
Yes, and civil liberties especially.
So back then, back when you were at Princeton, first there, what did you think of Einstein?
Well, I mean, I admired him tremendously, of course, both as a scientist and as a public figure. And we all knew he was a great man, but we also considered him sort of out of it. He missed the bus as far as the physics that was going on after the war.
Now, didn't you also get to know Niels Bohr, who often came to visit?
Yes, and he was totally different. I mean, Bohr was, of course, about the same age as Einstein, but much more in touch. And so he talked to everybody. He was interested in everything. He came to seminars. He also came to lunch. We had a lot of interaction with him.
So it's fascinating to hear you tell these stories. I mean, because you're talking about the giants of modern physics. I mean, some of the people who founded the physics that we know today. This seems like it was a golden age of science. I mean, what I would call a heroic age, when major discoveries about the nature of reality were revealed. Do you look back at it that way?
Yes. I mean, of course, the real golden age was the 20s when quantum mechanics was developed. I mean, quantum mechanics was a much bigger revolution in the 20s than what happened in the 50s when I was involved. So ours was sort of a silver age as compared with the golden age. But still, it was a good time to do physics. And it was a time when bright kids were, most of us went into physics. And so it was a time of opportunity. I mean, you didn't worry about getting a job. Any sort of second-rate physicist could do first-rate work.
Well, I mean, this was also a time when certain scientists were true heroes. I mean, Einstein above all, but you also had people like Feynman. And I guess I wonder if we still have those kinds of heroes in science today.
Well, I would say they mostly are going into biology now. So the same kind of people who would have become physicists in those days, nowadays they're tend to become biologists. And now, of course, a lot of people who are really computer scientists are actually doing biology.
So why is biology a more exciting area to work in than physics is now? Because, I mean, a lot of people would say there's all kinds of interesting stuff happening in physics, but you're saying the action is really in biology.
Well, it's a question of speed. I mean, physics has slowed down tremendously. And in the 1940s, when I came into physics, a really important experiment would take 3 months to do. I mean, it would sit on a table. It would take 2 months doing the construction, putting the apparatus together, 1 month doing the experiment, and it's done. Well, now it takes 10 years. So a typical physics experiment today involves a whole army of people. It takes millions and millions of dollars, or maybe billions, and it takes 10 years. So the whole thing has slowed down tremendously. In biology, it's still pretty rapid by comparison. Biology today is about where physics was in the 1950s.
Now, we've been talking about a lot of the great scientists who you've known personally, and I'm wondering if you can generalize at all about the personal or the intellectual attributes that make a great scientist, other than just, you know, out-and-out genius.
Yes, it's never easy to define, and they're all different. They have a tendency to become a bit crazy when they get old. They sort of lose a sense of proportion. That made Bohr rather unusual, that he kept his sense of proportion right up to the end.
Is it the willingness to risk your reputation, to take on, you know, projects that other people think won't work, to sort of pursue crazy ideas? What is it that, if you can generalize it all, that leads to great breakthroughs?
Yes. I mean, first of all, it helps to be ignorant. I always say the time when I did my best work was when I was most ignorant. And I think that's true fairly generally. Knowing too much is a great handicap. I mean, especially if you've been teaching for some years, then things get so fixed in your mind, it's impossible to think outside the box. And I was in the lucky position of jumping into physics without ever having taken any courses in physics. I'd only been a pure mathematician up till that point, so I was completely ignorant of...
I would think that would be a problem. You would really need to have that background to work as a physicist.
Well, a little bit, of course, does help, but not too much.
Freeman Dyson is a legend of modern physics. At 93, he still works at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Studies. That was an excerpt from Steve Paulson's interview with him for Nautilus magazine. And you can find the full piece on our website at ttbook.org.